This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 13 years ago, Nia Wilson was working full-time as a mother and part-time at Whole Foods in Durham. She'd taken the grocery store gig because she figured a retail job wouldn't add much pressure to her already stressful home life. She didn't want a challenge, but she found one anyway. During a Whole Foods shift, she met two men, Philip Shabazz and Howard Kraft, and they were discussing a nonprofit organization they co-founded called Spirit House. Spirit House challenges community members of all ages to be involved in social change, but it places a lot of its focus on youth in Durham, encouraging them to explore the social landscape through art, media projects, oral history, and activism. Nia Wilson is now the executive director of Spirit House, and she's my guest on the program this hour. Welcome to the State of Things.
Hi.
It's good to have you here. Tell us a little bit. Let's start with Spirit House. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the mission of Spirit House.
So the official mission of Spirit House is that we use art and media to support the empowerment of communities that are impacted by poverty, racism, gender discrimination through grassroots programming and cultural organizing. We do a lot of it with young people in and out of the schools. We also work with families. We do a lot of work with women who have been impacted by, like I said, poverty and things like that, domestic violence, always through art and culture.
Why art and culture?
Well, because we have to understand where our power comes from. It comes from our culture and our history, the things that we know, the things that we've always known. It's a place where we can envision what it is that we want for our lives, what we want for our futures. It's a place where we can remember what has been, not only for us, but for our families, for those that have come before us. And it's a great way to be able to explore what is happening with each other.
We're living in our culture, though. We're kind of soaked in it. What is the artistic rendering? What does that have to do with empowerment and working way out of your situation?
Well, everyone doesn't necessarily always recognize that we're living in our culture. Things that we do on a daily basis may not seem to have power unless we actually take a moment to step back and see how they have power, where they have come from, and what they do to help us discover who we are and find our voices.
So take us back to that day that you ran into the co-founders of Spirit House at Whole Foods.
Yeah, I remember that day vividly. I was working in the cafe, the coffee part of Whole Foods, and this was not the first time, but on this particular day, there was a group of, I would say, 10 to 15 black people who came in, all locks in their hair, and they pushed these tables together, and they all sat down to have some sort of a meeting. And as I said, I had seen them before, but I wasn't sure who they were or what it was about. And so I kind of made my way up the steps in the cafe to clean off a table that was near them and try to kind of hear who they were and what was happening. And Philip Shabazz turned to me and he said, and who was the founder of Spirit House, he turned to me and said, when the revolution happens, will you be ready? And I said, why, yes. Yes, I will. And that was how we met. And then from that point on, they would come to visit me at the cafe every once in a while, and we would have conversations and tell me a little bit about what they were doing, and we would talk about, you know, who I was and the things that I wanted until eventually they welcomed me.
When Philip Shabazz said that to you, you're cleaning off a table, they're having a meeting, he's not really engaged with you at all up until that moment. I mean, did you take him seriously, and what did you think he meant when he said that?
Yes, I took him seriously. I felt that this was a group of people who were working to change things for their community. And so that's exactly what I thought he meant. Like, would I be ready to do whatever needed to be done to help to change things, to help make things better? And I had worked with young people forever from the time that I was a teenager. And that was all that I really wanted to do. And I felt like that was my role in the revolution, in working with young people. And so, yes, I was ready to get back to that.
It's an interesting yes, a radical yes, in a lot of ways to think about you at that moment. I want to take you back to what you were doing. You were a mother of two. You had also, your niece was with you. You're taking care of three children. And you're working at Whole Foods. So anybody says, by the way, do you have some spare time to save the world? Which is, you know, another way to put it, right? The answer might be no. I mean, did you do the assessment at the time? Did you calculate the cost of what that question might really involve and what it might ask of you?
No. I actually had four children at the time because I also have another son who I had taken in probably the year before that, who had come from Connecticut. He was a teenager. But I knew what I do or what I had been doing well, which was to help young people grow into who they were and develop and become change makers. And so when I would think about what my role in that was or is, I was already doing it. Even though it was on a smaller scale than what I had been doing before I had moved to North Carolina, I was already doing it. And so I was curious more than anything else to see what I could do, what else I could fit into my life. And I was doing it at Whole Foods. I mean, it is who I am.
How are you doing it? What do you mean?
Well, like just by talking to my coworkers, we would have the most interesting political conversations when we would be putting the frozen foods up, you know, in the frozen food aisle. So I was constantly talking about evolution, evolving, changing, you know, and the things that we needed to do to make lives better for ourselves.
And it's not an accident that you worked at Whole Foods either. You had some sense of the mission of that store, which is part of the reason you made the choice to work there?
No. I mean, I did, yes, all of that. But I went to Whole Foods because I just thought it was a cool place.
Mm-hmm. But you're the kind of person but that's it. You talk about deep conversations while you're putting the frozen shrimp in the freezer. You're that person. You're the person who somebody'd walk up to and say, a serious person would say, when the revolution comes, are you going to be ready?
Yeah.
And that's happened to you most of your life, do you think? I
think that I have found ways or gravitated towards people who were constantly thinking about change, thinking about making a difference. But I don't necessarily think it was for instance, in activist communities. I worked in childcare. I worked in pediatrician's office, but it was the places that I gravitated to, which were folks who were always thinking about how to make a difference.
And tell us more about the founding of Spirit House, Philip Chappaz. Maybe we'll step back and tell us a little bit about him, because he's pretty well known in Durham. He's been an instructor, as an artist in residence in Duke, and a bit of a character too, would you say?
He's very brilliant and captivating. Chappaz was working at the Mary Lou Williams Center at Duke, and he ran a poetry program with some of the students and some artists that were local artists, and they made a decision that they wanted to take the art off of the campus. They wanted to take it into community. They wanted to be able to use the art in the ways that were used, like in the Black Arts Movement, again, to help people to envision and be more self-determining and decide on better futures for themselves. And so that's how they started Spirit House. And that was the group of folks who I ran into at Whole Foods as they were beginning to build this organization that was going to help Black folks in particular begin to be more self-determining and envision better futures for themselves.
Where did the idea of Spirit House come from?
Well, Amiri Baraka actually founded a Spirit House in New Jersey back in the 70s. And it was embedded within a community in New Jersey, and they worked from there. They worked from that house and helping the community meet their needs. And so the idea around creating the Spirit House in Durham was to figure out a way to do something similar. Of course, we're at a different time period. But again, how can we actually use art and culture in a practical way to help people better their lives and their future? And Chappaz actually had Baraka here, brought him in for a visit, and mentioned to him that he wanted to use the name Spirit House and got Baraka's blessing to do that.
And Howard Kraft was part of that. He's a well-known playwright and creator and author of The Jade City Pharaoh, which
yes.
airs in this program. And
yes.
He was busy back then still trying to make sure that the arts were going to be an important part in whatever kinds of developments.
Right.
Occurred in
and
Durham.
Howard and Shabazz both used their art in school, helping young people through poetry. A lot of the young people that I work with now will tell me that they met Shabazz in the, you know, third or fourth grade, and they remember him, and they can talk to you exactly about what his class was like and what they learned and what they did and what poems they wrote. And so the gift is wonderful that he can have, that they can both have those kind of impacts on young people locally.
Talk more about Spirit House. And the executive director, who is my guest this hour, Nia Wilson, is on the program. Just ahead, more about the creative projects going on at that Durham nonprofit. You'll hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nia Wilson is always surrounded by kids. It's part of her job. She's executive director of Spirit House, a Durham nonprofit that focuses on youth activism. But it's always has not always been that way for Nia, who was born the sixth of eight children. Going to find more about your upbringing and how you came to Durham. But first, I want to talk a little more about Spirit House. Where do the youth involve, the kids? Where do they come from?
They come from all over Durham. One of the programs that we had been running, where a lot of our youth came from at one point, was through New Horizons Alternative School, where we were working with a lot of young people who traditional school wasn't working for them. And we ran a program called Choosing Sides out of that program, which helped young people to decide what they wanted for their lives. And then a few years ago, we also, the Center for Documentary Studies had a program called Youth Noise Network, which was a youth radio show, and they decided to end the program, and they came to us and asked us if we would adopt the program. So at that point, we were not only working with the young people from New Horizons, but we were also working with different young people from different high schools all over.
You talked about that school being a place where kids are not quite fitting in their school, and there's so many systems stacked against, particularly people of low wealth in this community. And I'd like to play for you something now, a tape cut, to find out a little bit more, get a better idea of what you do at Spirit House. This is Angelo Jones, and he started coming to Spirit House when he was 16. Last year, he had the opportunity to travel with some other Spirit House youth to D.C., where he shared this experience with North Carolina's juvenile justice system.
I was incarcerated. I was let out on probation, which means I have a curfew. So during this time, I just got accepted into college. So I was on intensive, and my curfew was 6 o'clock, and dealing with going to class and going to the library to study and, you know, getting in the cafeteria in time before it gets too crowded. Like, it was hard.
Well, tell us a little more about Angelo.
I met Angelo when he was a 16-year-old student at New Horizons. He had been suspended from Hillside High School on a 365-day suspension, which meant that he couldn't go to any regular public school. So he spent a year of his time at New Horizons before he went back to Hillside and graduated, which is where you hear the clip about what went on when he went on to college. He is a brilliant young man, poet, artist, who just had some tough times and continued. The one of the wonderful things about Angelo is that he continued no matter what happened, no matter what obstacles came through. He also had a supportive family who just stuck by him through the tough times. Now he is 21 years old. He works a full-time job, has his own apartment, has a nice car, takes care of himself.
At that moment, he was about to go back to jail for a curfew violation.
He did go back to jail.
He was in school.
Yes.
And he's got to be average. He's 3.2 or something,
yes.
3.0. So he's doing well. But the alternative for him, because of his situation, was jail.
Yes.
And you argued that and helped him make the case that this is probably an inappropriate response to what's going on here.
Right. That clip was taken from a trip that we had taken to D.C. to Senator Kay Hagan's office. And we were there advocating for the reinstatement of the Juvenile Justice Prevention Act, which would prevent young people from going to prison for things that other alternatives could be made for. And so in Angelo's case, he had gotten through all of these obstacles when he was younger and actually got into college and was doing well in college. And because of a probation violation, he was taken out of school. He lost his scholarships. He lost his college and had to spend time in jail for something, for a probation violation. It made absolutely no sense. And you know, his intention is, and I know that he will get back to school. Like I said, the thing about Angelo is that he's going to keep going, that none of these obstacles are going to prevent him from being who he needs to be in his life. There's just things that have come around that have made it more difficult, but he'll get there.
And of course, the story's not unique.
Not at all. They are not unique at all. And
a full year suspension from school, that's the first setback.
Right.
And in terms of trying to meet the goals that we try to set in a normal society, now I'm really set back. And then I'm going back to jail, and even though I'm getting a 3.2.
Right.
So it makes it harder and harder. And this is some of the work you do at Spirit House. So take us back a little bit. You grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, one of eight kids. What was your neighborhood like?
We grew up in what was called Townhouse Gardens. So we were in a community filled with lots of children. It was actually newly built when my family moved in there, and so I grew up with people who I knew all my life. We were all there all the time. And I came, again, I'm number six of eight. I have five older brothers. And my mother also came from a large family, a fairly large family. My father's family was about, I think there's five of them. So there were also a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins and always people around.
And you said earlier that if the folks up there, some of your friends from Connecticut, heard the show, now they'd wonder who Nia was, because you were Nancy back
yes.
then.
Yes. Yeah, my name, my given name, my born name is Nancy Jean Wilson. And that's who what my parents call me and my family calls me, and the people in Connecticut know me as.
Nancy Wilson, not name for the singer?
Not at all.
Okay.
named because Nancy means gift from God, and I was the first girl after five boys, and my mother wanted to be sure that my name couldn't be shortened or turned into any kind of a name that sounded masculine, that I was her girl.
So, and what did your parents do?
My mother she's retired, but a nurse, and my father is a retired laborer. My mother did a lot of firsts. She was the first black majorette in her high school. She was the first black woman accepted into her nursing school. So she was told that she should be a secretary, but she went on to pursue her LPN.
Was that neighborhood you were living in pretty diverse?
It was somewhat diverse, but because Connecticut, where I'm from, is diverse. So, yeah, it was pretty diverse.
Yeah. And you were raised Jehovah's Witness. What role did religion play in your upbringing?
Yes, I was raised a Jehovah's Witness. So that was played a huge role in my upbringing and some of the decisions and the choices that that I made when I was younger. And it was really wonderful as far as some of the connections that I was able to make. And one very positive thing that I was speaking to a friend of mine about recently, who was also raised a Jehovah's Witness, is how it actually prepared us to do some of the things that we're doing now, because we spoke a lot and we did a lot of public speaking and a lot of reading. And so when it comes to like being on stage and pursuing the arts, it comes pretty naturally.
Would you call it a strict upbringing?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was strict in the fact that, you know, we were not really encouraged to pursue outside things, careers, or not really encouraged to go to college. The ideas, you know, around staying close to the religion, the church, and the folks that you're, that you know.
Well, after high school, you worked as a child care giver, and you did some pediatric nursing. It makes me wonder if you've always known that you were going to work with kids in one way or another.
I think that I've always worked with kids since I was a kid. When I graduated high school, I had a very short job in a factory, and then I found this job in childcare, and I stayed with that job for off and on for almost 10 years, and then I went on to nursing school and immediately got a job in pediatric nursing and realized that I was much happier day-to-day working with young people.
You talked about Jehovah's Witness being a religion that prepares you for presentation, but you're also a storyteller. Was that part of your religious upbringing, do you think, or when did you get attracted to the idea of telling stories?
I think it was more with the work that I was doing in early childhood education, because you can see how it impacts telling the stories and also gathering stories. So for me, I will say that I'm a storyteller, but also a story gatherer and someone who can facilitate or helps to facilitate or create space for other people to tell their stories. And the impact that that has on the listener is amazing. And so I think it was really working with young people and helping them to help me to develop and to be a good listener and a good storyteller.
You were drawn to the cycle of stories from the African tradition about Anansi, the spider.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that attraction.
Well, Anansi is a trickster. And so Anansi was always able to make his way no matter what the obstacles were, no matter who was in pursuit of him or trying to throw him off. He almost always, there were times when he was called to task for some of the things that he did, but he always made his way. And it's Anansi stories are told all over, and it's also a connection. You know, there's the connection between the stories from Africa and how they translated here in this country. So, like, the connection between Anansi and, like, the Brer Rabbit stories. And I was just very interested in making sure that young people knew those things, because you may hear the story, but you may not know any of the history or any of the background. And I think it's just really important. And to see someone who always is able to, no matter what the obstacle, work his way through it and come out in a positive way or in a way that makes sense for him is something that I feel like we need to communicate a lot more.
It's so important, isn't it, to have to allow especially young people to see that liminal space, those places along the borders where you can imagine yourself not in your current condition but in another condition. Mm-hmm. Imagine your role not written for you as it's been written and handed down to you, but a role that you can actually rewrite.
Right.
So characters like that are pretty important. And not only to listen to, but then what you get involved in is showing kids that they're the creators and the producers of this art,
right,
not just consumers.
Right, that our stories are all integral to what happens to us, what happens in our community, that we all have a role. And in order to actually step into that role, you have to know who you are and what your story is.
Now, in 1998, is this right, you took full custody of your brother's daughter, and you had two children of your own at the time. What motivated you to adopt your niece?
Well, I had, as we talked about earlier, my niece was born severely handicapped. She had something called Dandy-Walker brain malformation, which meant that her brain it wasn't wired correctly. She had no corpus. She had no line down the middle of her brain. And she also was born addicted to drugs. And she was immediately put into foster care, not with a family that could meet her medical needs because they didn't expect her to live. And I got a phone call from my brother saying that that she had been born, that she was 3 pounds, that there was no way that he was going to, or that they were taking custody away, and what could we do? And so I immediately went and found this angel and took her. And my mom and I and my brother did all that we could to care for her. there wasn't a, it was never a question. And I think the fact that because of her size and because of the many issues that she was born with, that, that the medical folks were not even thinking about what to do to help her live was pretty telling for like the kind of the value that we put on life. And so, yeah.
Another radical yes.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's easy to say no. It's like, look, I've got two kids. This is a difficult situation. It's well beyond me. I can't help you here. I'd love to, but I can't. Instead, the answer was yes. You then relocated and brought her with you when you came to Durham. What brought you to Durham?
Well, my sister was here. My sister had already moved to Durham. She was going to North Carolina Central. And my brother, Talia's father, had also relocated here for a job. And so in order for her to be close to her siblings, I moved here also. And then a year later, my parents came. And so we've been here ever since.
Reconstructed the family here. Your niece passed away at the age of 7?
Yeah, she was. It was 1 month before her 7th birthday. Wow. She got pneumonia. She had battled pneumonia off and on for many, many years, many different things. There was, the doctors often were telling us that, you know, she was too sick and she would get well and get well and get well. But it, but this one was pretty bad. And so, yeah, she passed away in my arms.
And that was someone who they didn't think was going to live much past infancy.
Right.
And again, the story frequently that she's not going to make it. And she lived for 7 years. And you were her primary caregiver.
Yes.
In that time. What did you take from that experience?
Well, the thing about Talia was, is that she, because of the way that her brain worked, she didn't do much of anything. She didn't talk. She couldn't feed herself. She smiled and she loved, and that's who she was. But we tend to, what I learned from watching people's engagement with her is that we tend to really dismiss people who we don't think have anything to offer. So much of my time was helping people to see who she was. They would draw blood from her arm and she wouldn't cry because she couldn't. But the assumption that she didn't have pain didn't make any sense to me. So when a nurse would say, oh, you're such a good girl because you're not crying, I would say, actually, I'm sure that that was very painful for her. Don't dismiss the fact that she's hurting now. And I felt like that was the story for so many of us. Even those of us who had voice, it certainly is my story. There were definitely things that I was dealing with that were painful for me that I was never able to articulate because the space was not there for me to articulate them. And so as I say all the time in learning to advocate for Talia and learning to speak and learning to make sure that she was seen and celebrated and loved, I also learned how to do that for myself. And so she was... is much more to me than a child that I cared for, that I have developed into the person that I am and have the ability that I have to create space for myself and for others to step in and to speak up because of who Talia was, because of that connection that I still have with her.
That growth, that development that occurred, that happened for you in relationship with this child, your niece, it was something you probably could never have predicted when you said, yeah, I'll take care of her.
No, I couldn't have. I took her, I spent my time, I just held her. She didn't do much of anything else. And so the amount of attention in order to discover every little thing about her, what every single breath meant, we don't usually get that ability in life to do those kind of things because we're too busy to be able to stop and do that. So I was forced to do that, which then had me looking at everything differently.
Some of the people that you've worked with at Spirit House were also personal heroes of yours. Nia Watkins passed away in 2007. Can you tell us about her?
2008.
Is it 2008?
Yeah, I said 7, but it was 2000, January 20th. Nayo she was a Southern organizer. She worked in Mississippi. She worked in North Carolina. She worked all across the South. Another artist using art and poetry to help the community find their voice. I met Nayo through Shabazz. He brought me to her apartment one day again and said, "This is Nayo Watkins, and you will learn from her. You will, sit at her feet, and you will learn what it means to work in community, to roll up your sleeves and work with people side by side and to listen." And so
I tell you what, let's take a break right there. I'll be interested to find out what you learned and what you heard when you sat at the feet of Nayo Watkins. I'm talking with Nia Wilson, and she is the executive director of Durham-based nonprofit Spirit House. Our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Nia Wilson, executive director of the nonprofit in Durham called Spirit House. It's an organization that encourages community activism in response to social issues like poverty, race, gender discrimination, health disparities, and it uses art and media projects to do all that. And Nia, you were talking about your encounter meeting Nayo Watkins, an organizer from the Deep South who had moved here to Durham.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so I met Nayo through Philip Shabazz, and we connected immediately. Nayo really knew how to listen and how to value everyone. And so she kind of taught me how to sit back and to listen to people's stories, to understand that the community knows, that people know what they want and people know what they need, and that my role as an organizer was not to tell anybody anything, but to actually listen and to see if there was a way to help to create space and facilitate things moving forward. She also worked with children. She had a nonprofit here called the Miki Center that worked with children with learning differences. She had the Miki Center was named for her son who had a learning difference and who actually committed suicide when he was a teenager because it was so difficult for him to move forward.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that that kind of organizing or that sort of theory behind the organizing requires a great deal of faith and can be deeply frustrating because you're not particularly organized around an issue. You know, we're going to get this legislation passed. We all sign the petition, give the money, go to the Capitol and make it happen. It's a trust that if people are listened to, that this spirit takes hold and the change happens when it will. It's out of your control. That's hard to take, isn't it?
No, not at all, because it's about transformation, and it's a question of what we want. Do we want of course, there are immediate changes that need to happen, and we know that in order for people's lives to be better. But there's also this transformation, this evolution that is constantly happening, that we're constantly in pursuit of. And there's a role for some of us to step into to make that happen. And so the frustration would be those immediate issues. That's just not where my role is. It's not where my comfort level is. And so I can be supportive of folks that are pursuing a certain issue, but I'm much more interested in the growth and the transformation and how organic that can be and just creating that space for it to happen and watching it, participating in it and seeing the journey, being on this journey.
Tell us about the stage production that you have underway right now at Spirit House.
So we have on February 24th, we have a Spirit House Presents production called Collective Sun, Reshape the Morning. And the production, since about 2008, we started really doing some work around the prison industrial complex, around how prison and policing impacts the African-American community, with working with the young people that I spoke about earlier and doing some traveling around the country and having conversations with a lot of people, using art and performance to facilitate those conversations. And from that, And also our own stories, the way that prison has impacted all of us, and having those conversations. And then from that, we work together collectively as a group of, there's at least, I'd say, 8 or 9 people who have helped to co-write this piece of work that looks at things that we don't always think about. Like, for instance, the idea of what it's like to be, one of my favorite parts of the performance is this, looking at what it's like to be the girlfriend of a young man who's constantly pulled over by the police. How does that impact your relationship? How does that impact you being able to spend time together? The frustration, where does that frustration go when he's angry about something that he has no control over? And so that's a way that the prison system impacts someone who may not even think about it. And so the production really is about opening again, beginning the conversations about those things.
Where did the stories come from?
Most of them are our own stories. So they come from either experiences that we've had or from, again, the way that something that we've seen or heard has impacted our lives. When the Oscar Grant case happened in Oakland in 2009, the young people that we work with were really impacted by the fact that this man was face down on a subway terminal and was shot in the back by the police officer. So they wrote about the impact that that had on them. So it's either our personal stories or things that matter to us.
And can you share some of the other scenes and give us a sense of what the show is going to look like?
Sure. I don't want to give you too much, but there are scenes that are, as I said, that are direct impact, like an encounter in a car, or North Carolina is one of 34 states that still shackles pregnant women when they're about to deliver their babies. So there's a scene that takes a look at that. There's a scene that takes a look at what it means every day to put a mask on our face so that we are acceptable to society, the things that we have to do to cover up who we are in order to get a job, in order to not be followed around in the store. And woven all through it is this idea that we know who we are inherently, that we know what our ancestry is. We are standing on the shoulders of these people who have survived all these things again, again, and again, and that we need to remember that this is our birthmark, and that if we continue to remember the legacy of our ancestors, that we can continue to work through this struggle and figure out ways that keep us keep us being who we are inherently, despite what else has happened on the outside.
How do you handle the conversations that must come up as you're working through the stories and the art? There have to be conversations about the situation out there, the system that, in particular, poor people and African-American people face that doesn't look like the same system that privileged white people face. It's not. It doesn't feel the same. Mm-hmm. How do you have that conversation?
Well, the conversation is different depending on who we're talking to. But usually they're always very positive and generative. The thing is that if we're looking at a system, and as opposed to blaming people, we're looking at a system that has been created that doesn't serve any of us, then that's a great place to begin conversation. And I believe that people have a choice about what they do or they do not want to talk about, what they do or do not want to explore, what they do or do not want to change. And so I can have a conversation with anyone about what the disparities are, about what's going on, and also about what our role is in it, because we all actually have a role. And so and then what we want to do, you know, what is the action that then shifts what's happening? And it doesn't have to be some major action where, you know, you walk out of the performance, for instance, and you go march up to Raleigh or march up to Washington and make specific demands. It could just be something that shifts in the way that you view things, the way that you view people. What happens when you drive down the road and you see that car pulled over? What do you do and what do you think? That's enough of a conversation starter where people will begin to shift what they do if they want to.
It does seem to me that some of those sites, the car pulled over on the side of the road, the evening news with the faces of those who are wanted up on the screen, can act without a certain amount of mindfulness about what's happening, about how the structures work, simply reinforce the stereotype.
That's exactly what it does. And so this is where we're making it real, where we're saying, you know, not just for the other who is not an African-American person, but excuse me, but even for ourselves, because one of the things that I've learned in all this work that I'm doing is that those stereotypes seep into our own DNA and we begin to believe that about ourselves. And so there is no way that we can facilitate any kind of change or transformation if we don't believe differently about ourselves. And so that's the work of Spirit House, that therein is the work that we do to help us to begin to love ourselves again fully and completely.
And the whole project, the whole production really is a community effort from start to finish.
Yes.
Tell us about sort of all of, I mean, even the tickets are handmade. Tell us about what
tickets,
goes into making
tickets
this.
Tickets are handmade. Everything is, so the first thing to know is that our cast is not formally trained. We have one formally trained cast member, but these are community folks, some of who have never been on stage at all, who feel like they want to participate in this. And what we've done is just ask people, continue to ask people how they want to be engaged. So it could be something as someone hosting a house party. Some of the things that we've done is to host house parties where we have these conversations on a smaller scale with folks who may not feel like they're ready to engage in a larger conversation, to hopefully prepare them to come to the production and participate in the conversation. We have postcards that are being worked on right now that are photos of the young people that we work with haikus that have been written over the years through another group that I'm a part of called Ubuntu. And these are all haikus around liberation and what it means to be free. And so these young people spent the summer taking pictures of themselves with the haikus, and we're going to develop those into postcards that will be sent the day of the performance, but also are available to send to loved ones who are incarcerated.
You know, you talked about these haikus centering on issues of freedom. It's interesting, isn't it, how we have conversations around criminal justice, economic systems, economic justice, social justice, but it really does come down to democracy, the fundamental issues of democracy and whether or not people enjoy the full liberties mm-hmm. that we promise as a democratic nation.
Right. And it's different for different people. And so if you are black or brown, or if you are poor, the freedoms and liberties that you get to enjoy are definitely different from someone who has a lot more privilege than you do. And so, you know, again, it's twofold. There's the one thing of being able to find joy and love right where we are, which will then help us to move into making demands that things shift for everyone. And so
How is it not the same, though? It's one criminal justice system. It's one set of laws. Everybody's judged the same. The standards are the same for everybody, aren't they? How is it that it can be applied differently?
Well, the laws are created to protect those who have more, who have the wealth, who it's created to keep a status quo, to keep things the way that they are. So while you may think that, you know, the laws are the same for everyone, it doesn't take much research to find out that that's actually not true. So a young person who may be arrested for selling drugs, who lives in, you know, quote unquote, the hood, and has a public defender, and, you know, comes from an area where the assumption is that there's a lot of criminal activity and drug dealing, is not treated the same as the young man who is the college student at Harvard, who then gets the case thrown out, who has been doing the same exact thing because he's able to have a good lawyer. Because as I read in an article a few months ago, a young man where the lawyer basically said to the judge, you know, he's got a whole life ahead of him. He's got all these things that are supposed to happen for him. We don't want to ruin it by sending him to jail because he messed up a little bit over here. That's not the same narrative that's told about the young man who is not in Harvard.
Right. And then once that mark is against you, once you get that first felony, then the treadmill goes into overdrive.
And right. North Carolina is one of two states that charges 16 and 17 year olds as adults still. And so therefore, once that charge is there, it's there forever. And it impacts your ability to go to college, to get a good job, sometimes your housing. It's all impacted by something that you may have done at 16 years old that's going to follow you for the rest of your natural life.
So what's your vision for Spirit House? How do you see it evolving?
I see us continuing to do what we do. I see us continuing to make space for everyone to step into who they are themselves, to finding their voice, to finding our voice, both individually and then communally, being able to stand strong, speak up, and make demands about what we need as families, as communities, and the changes that we need so that we can have the lives that we deserve.
How are you supported?
How are we supported?
Where's the money coming from?
We have some. Can I say we're not supported enough? But we do. We get some grant funding, small grants funding. And then we're also really supported a lot through grassroots community efforts, fundraising, fundraisers. We keep our overhead very small so that we don't spend our time spinning our wheels and how we're going to pay the rent. And not being able to do the work that we need to do in community. So, you know, our office is in the back room of my house, and we meet there often. And when we need more room, then we go to other places where we can go, and we bring our services to existing organizations.
Nia, thank you so much. What a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Nia Wilson is Executive Director of Spirit House in Durham. For more information, visit spirithouse-nc.org. The upcoming production of Collective Sun, Reshape the Morning, will premiere at Haytai Heritage Center February 24th, 6 o'clock. Tickets available at collectivesun.event-bright.com. And that's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you want to comment about a program or hear an archived edition of a past program, our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.